So ask yourself this, would you? What do you suppose happens in this economy when all that government relief money goes away? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today. I'm pretty sure the 23rd day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The future of this economy coming up after the fold. But first, real estate. This will come as news to hopefully none of you. But the absolutely bananas housing market in this country shows all signs of staying absolutely bananas. The median existing home price, remember, median is where half are more expensive, half are less. Nationally, the median existing home price in this economy hit an all-time high last month, more than $350,000 American dollars. Given that homes are the most expensive thing most of us buy, that plays out in a whole lot of ways, including what you might, in something of a stretch, call the secondary market, home flippers. People trying to make a quick buck by fixing up a fixer-upper. A new report from the real estate data company Atom Data shows that home flipping in the first quarter of 2021 was down to its lowest level in 20 years. Marketplace's Matt Levin explains what's going on with that.
If you still surf basic cable like I do, you'd think every other house in the country was being flipped.
Every flip is a gamble that can pay off big.
Oh, my God.
Wow. Or cost them everything.
That's Flip Wars, which aired on A&E. There's also HGTV's Flipper Flop and Masters of Flip and a zillion others. Charles Tassel runs Cornerstone Redevelopment in Cincinnati. He's been flipping houses for more than a decade. He says a more realistic show would be called Millennials Stole My Flip.
Millennials who typically over the last 10 years wanted houses that were ready to move into. We're now seeing, okay, I can't get exactly what I want. So I'll go for a fixer-upper, and I'm willing to do that.
Tassel says fewer listings and record-high prices, even for DREC, have eaten into profits. So have rising lumber costs and a contractor shortage. But he also blames YouTube.
This type of toilet, how do I mount this seat? Well, here's what YouTube says, and I had it done in 20 minutes, which is a lie, you know, plumbing issues. So.
Flipping took the biggest dive in the Sun Belt. Memphis saw an 80% drop. Maribel Owen co-owns Homeview Properties. She says many flippers in Memphis are pursuing a different model with longer-term revenue streams.
In Memphis, the market has really been a lot more for rentals. It's a light renovation usually, and then you rent it out.
Fewer flippers in the market won't necessarily lower prices. Brokers say some of the properties are simply too dilapidated to be fixed by amateurs, no matter how much YouTube they watch. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
One more quick real estate thing before we go on. A jurisprudential note on the wider real estate market. Maybe you saw this today from the Supreme Court this morning, that the structure of the Federal Housing Finance Agency, it regulates, among other things, the two big government-backed mortgage companies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which, as it happens, between them account for the overwhelming majority of mortgages in the United States. The structure of the FHFA, the court says, is unconstitutional. Among the many results of that, some of which might not be known for a while, the Trump-appointed director of the agency is out of a job, the White House says. Also, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac shares down about 35% today. As more of us get back on planes, the Federal Aviation Administration says it's going to give $8 billion to airports around the country. The money comes out of the last big virus relief package as the number of people passing through TSA checkpoints starts to top 2 million a day with some regularity. Still and although, as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports, the aviation recovery is at best a little turbulent.
For a few months last fall and winter, there were no regularly scheduled commercial flights going in and out of Dubuque Regional Airport in Iowa. American Airlines had temporarily suspended all three of its daily flights to Chicago.
In January, they returned with one flight a day. That got bumped up to two flights a day just recently.
Todd Dalsing is director of the airport, and he says it's starting to feel busier. But the one restaurant at the airport is still closed.
You know, it's hard to keep employees paid when you have a limited number of flights.
And there's only one place to rent a car now instead of two. It's been a tough year financially for all airports, says Kevin Burke. He's the CEO of the trade group Airports Council International North America.
The key revenue sources for airports are the landing fees they get from airlines, the concession fees that they get from the concessions at the airport, and the Ubers and Lyfts that pay a fee to get into airports. All that revenue was way, way, way down during the past year.
It's starting to come back, Burke says, but not everywhere yet. Steve Dixon, the FAA administrator, looks at air traffic numbers every day.
Generally speaking, our large domestic hubs are doing pretty well.
Especially ones that get a lot of vacation travelers. But airports that rely more on business and international travel are taking longer to recover. Dixon says airports will be able to use these federal grants to pay staff, cover operating costs, pay off debt, and keep restaurants and other businesses open.
If you've been in an airport, you know how important all the services are. Car rentals, restaurants, catering businesses, things like that.
Dixon says all of those businesses are extremely important to travelers and the economy. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Wednesday, a little up, a little down. Your guess is as good as mine as to what's going on. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Maybe you missed this. Full disclosure, I did. But we are, it turns out, smack dab in the middle of Cinema Week 2021. Movie theaters and industry groups getting together to promote the culture of movie going now that we can. Stephanie Silverman is the executive director of the Belcour Theater in Nashville. Also, she is one of the 10 people we've been following in our series, The United States of Work. Well, 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 Stephanie Silverman, as I live and breathe.
Well, hello, Kai Rizdahl. Nice to hear your voice again.
Good to talk to you, too. How are you? How you been?
You know, pretty good all in all. You know, still on the COVID roller coaster, but
yeah,
it's a good new phase, I think. Starting to work our way back to some sense of normalcy.
You are open in person, yes? I can go see a movie next time I come to Nashville?
You can, every single day of the week. It's been good. We reopened officially on April 23rd. So it's been a few weeks now.
So what's it like on a Friday night? I mean, are there crowds and lines? Are there people eating popcorn and all that good stuff?
There are definitely people eating popcorn. Crowds, it's very inconsistent, I would just say right now. It's been interesting to us as we watch sort of what people are coming to. You know, we have a sold-out screening of the film Children of Men tonight, right? In the middle of the week, a movie that has been out in the world for a long time, but we have a speaker and a bunch of other stuff around it, and that's sold out for us. Is at 50% capacity, of course, right now.
Yeah.
But, you know, some of the other stuff, some of the new release stuff that also might have a life on another streaming platform, say, it's slower. So time for some heavy curation to really find the right mix.
Yeah, this is a little touchy-feelier than I usually get, but people missed you, clearly.
Yeah, they did. And we missed them. It's been pretty great to be back, and especially for our to see our regulars, to see people just standing in the lobby talking about movies after a movie. It's powerful. It's really rewarding, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah, and validating, right, in terms of what you do, right?
Totally.
Because we've
totally
talked about this before. You're a mission-driven person and a mission-driven organization. But even a mission-driven organization needs money. Last time we had you on, we talked about the Shuttered Venue Operators Grant and how you were kind of hanging fire on that and trying to get some money. And where does that stand?
Well, our application did move from submitted to under review yesterday, which is good. Of course, the applications have been in for over 9 weeks now, so we're still waiting. And this money was legislatively authorized in December.
Wow.
So the gift of the support, it was really like a light at the end of the tunnel, but the process has been, I will just say, maddening is the kindest word I can use to describe it right now.
Do you think you're out of the woods?
You know, I do think we are. I think the sort of the rough sea things ahead of us are just getting people used to being in a space like a theater again.
Yeah.
And a part of it, I think, is just like the rapidness of change. So I think we're just in the relearning process, and theaters are kind of at the end of the tail, sort of.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we are still working through what was a pandemic release model for new movies, right? Which was streaming and maybe in the 4 theaters that were open in the country.
Right. So that's the structural changes question, right? Because there are clearly structural changes coming to your industry, and how you can deal with that.
Well, we've always been pretty good at navigating these things through the way we program, frankly, just by directly marketing movies to audiences in a way that's different from the larger national model. But I also know that I think maybe even our distributor friends are going to learn some lessons about just going straight to streaming and how many people actually see that wonderful filmmaker's movie if they don't give it the kind of exhibition first release, whether those windows stay open as long as they used to, I don't know. But I still really feel that what we do in movie world is something different for that piece of work than what happens when it's on in TV world in your house.
Yeah. Stephanie Silverman, she's the executive director of the Belcourt Theater there in Nashville, Tennessee. Trying to get by, trying to get back is what they're doing. Stephanie, thanks a lot. It's really good to talk to you again.
Thanks, Kai. It's really good to talk to you, too.
Okay, back to real estate here for just a second, because it matters, right? We have told you, I can't count how many times, including today as it happens, about residential property, about bidding wars and cash offers and waivers of contingencies. Basically, anything goes out there. Turns out some commercial real estate is just as hot, specifically warehouses. Marketplace's Andy Euler is on that one.
Lizzie Newsome runs Kappa Toys on the Las Vegas Strip. It's where you go if you want to pick up the latest Japanese action figures or maybe a retro Batman dice kit. She says her business more than doubled its projected sales in the past year, which means she had to find a bigger warehouse to put all those toys in.
Honestly, the new space is like 10 times bigger. We have like 400 square feet right now, and we're moving into a 4,000 square foot warehouse.
And she says now that they have more warehouse space, they'll be able to shift some focus to their online offerings. And that shift to e-commerce is in part what's led to the need for bigger and more warehouses. A new report from the commercial real estate firm CBRE says e-commerce is expected to grow to a quarter of all retail sales by 2025. And if that happens, the U.S. will need an additional 330 million square feet of distribution space just to handle it. Matt Wallasek is a research analyst at CBRE.
Retailers, general wholesalers, third-party logistics providers are seeking accommodation. They need space to store their goods. And then with all the supply chain volatility, we're expecting even more demand for warehouse space.
He says the old just-in-time inventory management strategy, where retailers keep just enough product just in time for customers to buy it, just doesn't work anymore.
The old retail big box is now a warehouse big box.
That's Casey Conway, chief economist at the commercial real estate consulting firm CCIM.
And if you don't have the technology and the supply chain infrastructure, the logistics infrastructure to meet that, you're a retailer that goes out of business.
He says, of course, the big players like Amazon, Walmart, Home Depot, and others have accelerated the shift to the need for more warehouse space. But even small businesses like Kappa Toys in Vegas have to be ready to adjust to new logistics realities on a dime. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Should it be somehow that you miss us on the air, you can get us on a podcast, you know, marketplace.org or the platform of your choice. We are downloadable wherever you like. Coming up.
I have not had a car for 13 years.
So what you gonna buy, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 71 points today, 0.2%, 33,874. The NASDAQ rose 18 points, 0.1%, 14,271. The S&P 500 off about 4 points, 0.1% or so, 42.41. Energy stocks charged higher in line with rising oil prices. Diamondback Energy polished up 0.6%. ExxonMobil added 0.7%. Occidental up 0.3%. In the realm of housing, the National Association of Realtors issued a new report on home sales today. It concluded that the U.S. housing market is short 5.5 million homes. Now, let's remember the National Association of Realtors is the real estate lobbying group. But the report authored for the group by the Rosen Consulting Group said limited supply has pushed up the cost of houses. Funny the way that works, isn't it? Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.48%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Okay, as promised, the future of this economy now. In keeping with the longstanding practice of this program to give you tomorrow's news today, we direct your attention now to the final reading of first quarter economic growth, which will be delivered to us at 8:30 tomorrow morning Eastern Time, as always, the way these things are measured, by the good people at the Bureau of Economic Analysis. Best guess is, what with all the fiscal stimulus, that's the virus relief money, and the easy monetary policy, that's the Fed keeping interest rates low, best guesses are that gross domestic product growth January through March is going to come in at a ripping 6.4% on an annualized basis. And expectations are it's going to stay that way through the summer. However, comma. One might reasonably ask, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer did, what happens when summer's over and the money runs out?
Let's pretend it's late October. The leaves are changing, the kids are agonizing about what they'll be for Halloween, and I'm talking to Doug Roberts about economic growth, GDP, which measures economic output, basically all the goods and services we produce. He says by the fall, we'll have just gotten over the economic sugar high of the summer when pent-up demand sent the economy sky high.
You've had a beach ball that's been pulled underwater for an extended period of time, so to speak, with the economy during COVID.
Roberts is founder and chief investment strategist at Channel Capital Research. He says Congress could get the economy a bounce this fall by agreeing on an infrastructure package with President Biden, which then
goes into effect next year and clicks in right maybe when the beach ball needs a little bit more air. That could be very, very positive.
But there's a caveat. Roberts says the fall could also bring some economic threats. Some people are behind on their rent. Others have deferred their mortgage payments. Foreclosures could be looming.
So right now, those are going to be the three, if you want to call it, horsemen of the apocalypse that we really don't know where we are.
But those horsemen will be met by a powerful force this fall. The holidays will be around the corner. Store shelves of candy and costumes will be replaced by Santa and displays of the video games my kids have been begging me for. Michelle Meyer, head of U.S. economics at Bank of America, says consumers won't be holding back.
And importantly, not just buying stuff, but also going places, going out on vacations or to different leisure activities, visiting family and friends.
Meyer does expect GDP growth to peak in early summer, rising 11% from the first quarter of the year. Still, she says all that holiday spending and traveling will help keep the economy growing this fall, just not as fast, up around 5% from the summer. Here's another caveat, though. The Grinch that could steal GDP growth, inflation. Beth Ann Bovino, chief U.S. economist at S&P Global Ratings, says if prices rise, consumer spending could fall.
Given how prices have been so low during the pandemic, they may feel a bit of a sticker shock when they go to the gas pump.
Bovino says GDP growth this fall could also be tripped up by her three horsemen fears: labor shortages, continuing kinks in supply chains, or outbreaks of new COVID strains. But in spite of all these risks, her outlook for economic growth in the last quarter of the year is pretty rosy.
We're not expecting it to drop off a cliff. We're still looking for a growth rate of about 2.8%.
Overall, for 2021, Bovino predicts we'll see the strongest GDP growth in 37 years. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
According to Kelley Blue Book, the average price for a new car in May of this year was $41,263. That's up from where it was in April, just a percentage point or so, but still, it's really high. Prices alone, though, do not a full car purchase make. There are a lot of other things to think about, especially if you are thinking green, trying to minimize the environmental footprint of whatever you're going to drive. And that leads me to Amy Harder. She is the VP of Publishing at Breakthrough Energy. That's a clean energy project. And she had a column in Axios the other day where she talked about her quest to buy a clean car.
I have not had a car for 13 years, and I very reluctantly decided I needed to buy a car. I would say I had three criteria. The first is that I wanted it to be as efficient and as clean as possible. The second one is I wanted to spend $30,000 or less. The last criteria, I wanted it to be versatile. I wanted to be able to take it to the mountains and drive it in the snow if need be. I was looking at a fully electric, plug-in hybrid, or conventional hybrid. I didn't actually go and test drive any fully electric cars. I decided that those were not in my wheelhouse right now for a couple of reasons. Where I live here in Seattle, it's an old building and there's really no way to plug in my car. There is actually a very ancient looking plug-in out front. And I actually went there one night and tried to plug in my iPhone and it wouldn't even plug in my iPhone. And the second question is most electric cars are quite expensive. You know, there's the Nissan Leaf and others that are more affordable, but almost none of them come in all-wheel drive. So I wrote that off. So then I started looking at plug-in hybrids. Subaru actually makes a Crosstrek hybrid. And I was like, oh, that's great. That checks all my boxes. I put into the search engine to find a car. The closest hybrid for sale was in Portland, Oregon. I learned because of a messy mix of state policies, automakers are actually primarily selling their plug-in hybrids to states that are following California's zero emission vehicle law. I checked with Subaru Corporate. The corporate spokesperson told me that Seattle area dealerships cannot service the plug-in hybrid Crosstrek. And I don't feel comfortable buying a car that I would have to somehow get 200 miles away to get serviced if it broke down. Unfortunately, I had to write off the plug-in hybrid. So then that left conventional hybrids, which is, of course, a gasoline engine that uses regenerative braking to power the vehicle's batteries. Ultimately, I went with the Prius. And I like to joke that it's like going into the grocery store saying you're going to find the most exciting, trending ice cream flavor ever, and you come out with vanilla. So I decided to lease the Prius instead of buy it. And the internet tells you you should almost never lease a car. But to me, that's really short-sighted because the auto industry is rapidly changing. And I'm hopeful that in 3 years, I will have a lot more options that fit my three criteria that are a lot cleaner.
Tell you what, I'm ready to unload my minivan. Amy Harder there at Breakthrough Energy. This final note on the way out today, some good news after a year and a half of pandemic-induced stress. Saw this in Fast Company today. Stress, we all know, can make your hair go gray. But, say researchers at Columbia University, maybe not forever. They did microscopic examinations of how hair goes gray, like down in the follicle in response to stressful events, right? Graying in response to stress. And the deal is this. Once it's gray and out of the follicle, hair is gray forever. Give it up. But if the stressful event ends, like, say, a pandemic, before the hair grows out of the follicle, there is a chance it could go dark again. I will just say here, though, that for some of us, there ain't no amount of graying reversal that is going to help anything. All right, we're going, but here is your moment of economic context. I guess you filed this one under the promise, but also the perils of a recovering economy. Mentioned this in the numbers real quick. Crude oil, the U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate, to be clear, topped $74 a barrel at one point today, the highest it's been in almost 3 years. I think I paid like $4.50 to fill up that minivan, by the way. That's California, though. All right. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Jay Seabolt, Liana Squalachi, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Dorado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.